Okay, good morning on this lovely, warm, toasty morning. Look, be grateful. Where I come from in Philadelphia, they had 15 inches of snow yesterday, and it's 4 degrees, so it's not quite so cold, but it's bad there too. Are there any questions? Yes.
So can you say something about VL? And
yes, I will. Yeah. Tomorrow. Okay, I'm going to talk some more about the unitarity, well, the CKM matrix, Kobayashi Kabibo Kobayashi Maskawa, and the unitarity triangle. And recall that for three families, the mismatch between the up quarks and down quarks, or between the Yukawa interactions and the weak interactions, means that the weak charge currents involve these 3x3 unitary matrices. The hadronic part is the CKM matrix. There's a lot of parameterizations of it, but the relevant elements are the one U to D, U to S, U to B, etc. And of course, they're measured in different ways. This comes from beta decay and kaon decays and heavy bottom quark decays and charm decays and production of charm in neutrino experiments and also in mixing experiments, much like the K0, K0 bar I talked about yesterday and the analog for heavy quarks. There's several parameterizations of it. It has, of course, three angles and one CP violating phase. And probably the most popular current parameterization is to write it as a product of three matrices. And Sij is the sine of some theta ij, and Cij is the cosine. And the first matrix just mixes the first two families, and S12 is basically the Kabibo angle, up to small, tiny corrections from the third family. I'll say in the outset that this angle is much larger than the other angles. And so this describes the Kabibo angle, and this describes the mixing between the second and third families, and this one describes the mixing between the first and third, and delta is the CP violating phase. In case I forget to say it later, CP violation, at some point people had sort of assumed that CP violation was intrinsically small, which would mean small phase, but that's actually not the case. The reason CP violation is small is because these mixing angles are small, and any process that has observable CP violation, it's because there are interference between Feynman diagrams, and you need all three families to contribute. You need a set of Feynman diagrams for a process in which all three angles enter. So any CP violating effect is actually going to be proportional to sine theta 1,2 times sine theta 1,3 times sine theta 2,3 times something involving delta. And it's actually because the angles are small and not because the CP is intrinsically small. And I like to make the statement that people of a generation before mine were shocked that CP was violated, but they shouldn't have been. And that's because complex phase quantum mechanics is based on complex numbers, and CP violation is just complex numbers, except for the ones that you can't observe them all, but whenever you can observe them, you sort of expect it to be there. The magnitudes of doesn't mean the determinant. This means the magnitudes of the elements, this to see, are roughly shown here. You see this 2x2 block, that's the Kabibo part, and that's the only big rotation. And the transitions between the second and third family are much smaller, and the transitions between the third family and the first family are smaller still. So that's in, that was sort of lucky historically, because historically, when they didn't know about the third family, it you know, it was a good approximation to ignore it here. There's an approximate parameterization that I will also write down, because it's actually easy enough to almost remember. An approximate parameterization, it's not exactly unitary, but it's approximately unitary, is that this is 1 minus lambda squared over 2 lambda minus lambda 1 minus lambda squared by 2 a lambda cubed rho minus I eta a lambda squared 1 a lambda cubed 1 minus rho minus I eta and minus a lambda squared, where lambda is around 0.23. That's basically the sine of the Kabibel angle. And A is known very well. A is a border 1, and it's about 0.81 from bottom quark decay. From that transition. And rho and eta are expected to be of order 1. Could be a half or something. But the main point is that the first of all, eta represents the CP violation. And A, rho, and eta are all sort of order 1. So all the small stuff is in this parameter lambda. So the Kabibel angle is first order, and then these transitions are second order, and these transitions are third order. And so this is just a sort of approximate parameterization. It's not really unitary, but the corrections, one can write a corrected form of this, which I won't go into, that's even more closer to unitary. But if you view this as some sort of expansion, then the next term, which I haven't written, would be order lambda to the 4, and it's only the full expansion that's exactly unitary, but for most purposes, that's good enough. And we'll see why in a moment why I want to do that. Okay, so people have studied this matrix extensively, especially in recent years. And the reason they want to study it is to test unitarity. Or at least test it to whatever precision you can. Now, obviously, if you have tested or more precise than this approximate form, then you have to use a better form. But the main point is one wants to test the unitarity, namely V dagger equals V dagger V equals the identity. And the reason that this is so important is that from the basic principles of quantum mechanics, it has to be unitary if the standard model is exactly correct. And any apparent deviation from unitarity would mean that there's some interactions or something going on beyond the standard model. For example, just as a trivial example, if we didn't know about the third family, if this were the correct matrix, but we didn't know about the third family, then when you multiply out those exact forms and test whether the 2x2 upper 2x2 subblock was unitary, it wouldn't be quite unitary. The last factor is, but when you put the others in, it wouldn't be. And so by very precise measurements just of those four elements, one could have inferred that there must be some other physics not taken into account. It could be more fermions, it could be new interactions, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, the unitarity, there's two aspects to unitarity. The first aspect is the diagonal elements must be one. So the VV dagger. So for example, VV dagger 1, 1 should be 1. And that's VUD squared plus VUS squared plus VUB squared. And this is very, very precisely measured from the so-called super-allowed beta decays. Those are certain heavy nuclei in which from isospin there's virtually no theoretical uncertainties. These are very well measured from kaon decays. These are measured from bottom decays, and actually this third term is very small. Experimentally, this is equal to 0.9999 plus or minus 0.0010. That is, it's consistent with 1. This is a major triumph, much more than you might at first guess. That's because you need not only precise experiments, but you need precise theory. If you just took the approximate tree-level formulae for beta decay, and you need muon decay, of course, also to give you the Fermi constant, which is needed before you can extract these things. If you just took all beta decay and muon decay with the tree-level formulae that we've written down and derived here, you would find 3% corrections to the extracted values. You'd get something like 1.03. That's because those theoretical correction, there are theoretical corrections, like muon decay has mu minus nu mu you have corrections such as you can exchange a photon between here and here, for example. And there are other corrections as well. But and if you just work in the Fermi theory, not the full standard model, those corrections are divergent. And they're non-renormalizable. So they're meaningless. Actually, it turns out by some accident that the QED corrections to muon decay actually can be absorbed into alpha, but the ones to beta decay are not. And so you couldn't calculate those corrections. It's only in the full standard model where you get cancellations because of Z exchange and things like that, that it's meaningful. And then once you can do the calculations, it works beautifully. And I should say that for about 20 or 25 years, this didn't seem to work properly. And then it was finally realized after about 25 years that it wasn't a problem with the standard model, and it wasn't a problem with the nuclear physics and beta decay, but some of the old experiments in kaon decay actually had some subtle systematic mistakes, which were corrected in later experiments. But anyway, the other aspect is that V dagger, I'll write it V dagger V, 3, 1 should be 0. These are just samples. There's a 2, 2 and a 3, 3, and there's a different elements here, and you can do VV dagger instead. So there's actually a lot of these relations. I'm only writing down the ones that are best tested here. So this is equal to VUB star VUD plus VCB star VCD plus VTB star VTB, and this should add up to 0. Now, this test and the related ones for other components are known as the unit. That was the fixed board. I can't raise it. Okay. Anyway, this is known as the unitarity triangle test. And there's been enormous effort in the last 15 years in testing this. Now, why is it a triangle? Well, these are complex numbers. And any complex number can be represented as a vector in a two-dimensional vector space. And so in some two-dimensional vector space, you should have that this is a vector, and that's a vector, and the last one's a vector, and so they should add up to zero. They should form a triangle. And if they don't form a triangle when you measure all elements, then you know that there was something wrong. One of the experiments is wrong, or the theory is wrong, or there's new physics or something. Now, and in fact, turns out if there were no CP violation, then all of these would be along the real axis. And so somehow the area of the triangle is measuring the amount of CP violation. OK, I'm not going to go through all the details of how this unitarity triangle is parametrized and so forth. I will simply say that, first of all, some of the elements are very well known. So for example, VCB star times VCD in magnitude is well known. And that's just the length of this piece here. This is the first term, this is the second term, and that's actually the third term there. So this length is actually very well known. And so one may as well just divide it out. And in the end, the prediction is that in terms of that rho and eta, which is partially hidden, one expects to have in the rho eta plane, by dividing that out, one of the elements just is at 0, 1. That's this vertex. And the true value should be at some point rho eta, which is not known all that well to begin with. And then the other elements, when renormalized, other vectors, when this is divided out, should form vectors that line up something like this. And by the way, this these angles in this parametrization are called alpha, gamma, and beta. And this vector is rho plus I eta. And this is 1 minus rho minus I eta. If you look at conventional plots of this, you'll see a bar over every one of those. The bar is just some higher order correction to that approximation, which I won't write. Yes?
The last term, should that be TD? The last term? UV, TD, or?
Thank you.
So now the idea is the rates, that is, rates can determine the sides. So as an example, the rate for charm to go, or rather bottom, to decay into up plus, let's say, for example, mu minus nu mu. And of course, this is part of a meson. Relative to the rate for bottom goes to charm plus mu minus nu mu, actually determines the length of this side. And so that is measured. And I'm not going to try to do this whole construction in detail, but from that measurement, one has some and determine some circle in this plane. One's only measuring the length of that vector. And of course, there's in reality going to be some experimental uncertainty. So one's really just measures a ring. And there are other measurements, CP can, things that don't really involve CP that determine this length here. And for example, the, you know, I talked about the for example, the delta MK equals the M K 1 minus MK 2 of mixing of the two neutral kaon states. And there are similar things, delta M B sub D and delta M B sub S. B 0 sub D is the D B bar state. B 0 S is equal to the S B bar. And then the B bars are the antiparticles. And there's also a state D, which is the C U bar, and D zero, which is the C bar U. These also mix, these mix, and much of the phenomenon I described yesterday for the kaon mixing has analogs here. And basically from those measurements, one determines another circle, which is the, gives you this length. And so if the standard model in this sector is correct, those two things intersect just at two points. So other measurements should be consistent with that. There are the angles can be determined from various specific CP violating effects. So and for example, well, let me at this point just say there are many, many redundant measurements, many more than, I mean, two measurements is enough to determine the intersection up to a twofold ambiguity. And then there are other measurements that determine the angles or determine various ellipses in that plane. And in fact, they all intersect very nicely in that upper intersection point. And I put the current plot of all the experimental constraints on the wiki, if you want to look at it. It was a something of a heroic effort. In all frankness, 20 years ago, my own belief was that it would never be a very successful program because of strong interaction uncertainties in the decays. But in fact, they have been largely overcome, and the agreement was very good. So the triangle really closes. There's no significant evidence for any deviations. Now, the measurements of the CP violation, let me just remind you a little bit of the CP violation. We saw that yesterday that we had these two states, that the K long and the K short, and that the K short and K long would be K1 minus or plus K2 over root 2 in the absence of CP violation. And these are the states of definite strangeness that are relevant to the strong interactions. And these are the states that are the mass eigenstates when you include the second order weak interaction effects. So basically, diagrams like D S bar, S D bar, and diagrams like this cause mixing between the two states so that these are the mass eigenstates. And if there were no CP violation, then these would be CP eigenstates. And if you were to calculate this without the top quark, you would in fact find that there's no CP violation. And with the top quark, there is CP violation. You really have six diagrams here. And there are six others in which the W's go in the other direction. And so you have all the angles, all the things interfere in the total amplitude. And there's actually a tiny CP violation that leads to a small admixture of the wrong CP. So the point is that you have K long goes to pi plus, pi minus, or pi zero. Pi zero. This has a CP of minus one. This had a CP eigenvalue of plus one. And so, and the rate, well, the amplitude for this is about 10 to the minus three of normal of the K short to 2 pi amplitude. The rate is also about 10 to minus 3, but it's in the amplitude's the relevant thing. So this indicated CP violation in nature, and it can come about two ways from the KK bar mixing. You should have shouted at me. This is K0 and K0 bar, not K1 and K2. And so here's K0, K0 bar. The CP violation in these diagrams can lead to mixings which violate CP, so that this is not, these are not the actual eigenstates, but the thing we, the long-lived one actually has a little bit of admixture of the other state. Or from, and or from the decay amplitude. That is, this might be the proper K long, might in fact be the correct mass eigenstate, but it could be that just somehow in the decay amplitude there's some CP violation. And this is actually, it took it's only about 10 years ago that these were finally totally disentangled. You can separate out these. This is a 10 to the minus 3 effect in amplitude, and this is a 10 to the minus 6 effect in amplitude. And you can disentangle them because the two contributions give slightly different effects on the pi plus, pi minus, and the pi zero, pi zero. And it was heroic. I mean, this is one part in a million type effect. It's 10 to the minus 3 up 10 to the minus 3. And the dominant contribution to the decay amplitude is for the kaons. The dominant contribution would be a diagram. I'm going to draw it sideways instead of. So for example, K0 bar, this side, S D U C T W minus, and then here, this would be D, and this can be a gluon, or a W, or a Z, or a photon. turns out, after a lot of theoretical work, that this is believed to be the dominant contribution in the decay amplitude, whereas these box diagrams are the dominant things from the mixing. And I wanted to draw the diagram because you may, if you're associated with particle physics at all, you will hear the term penguin diagram. And that's because this diagram, if you use your imagination, looks a little bit like a penguin. There's a number of people in physics who like to make sort of jokes, and one of those people was sort of somebody bet him that he couldn't figure out a way to use the word penguin in a published paper, and so he did. So, okay, that's all I really want to do on this. For the in the kaon system, there's relatively limited information that one has. Basically, it's only the rates for these two processes. There's a couple other things that are not experimentally independent, but not theoretically. And the mixing actually gives in that picture on top. That actually gives a relatively weak constraint. This is the CP violation in the kaon system. It was enough to eliminate this solution. However, in the last 15 years or 20 years, there have been intense studies of the neutral B system and other aspects of the B at dedicated E plus E minus colliders in at Stanford, part of the SLAC complex, and at Bell at the KEK lab in Japan, and also at hadron colliders like the Tevatron, in which one produces, in hadron colliders you produce a lot more B mesons, but the environment is not as clean. And the mixing and decays in these sectors have been studied in great detail, and there's lots of CP violations observed. Some of there is CP violation again in both the mixing from box diagrams, basically the same diagrams, just putting a bottom instead of a strange in the diagram, and also in the decay amplitudes. And these penguin diagrams replacing the S by a B are one of the contributions. There are other contributions. That's not the only thing that can lead to CP violation in the decays, but it's important. At any rate, the bottom line is that now there are good measurements. Like, for example, there was a very nice measurement that basically determined the angle to be like this. And then there, since one's measuring a sine of an angle, there were other solutions that are just off in the middle of nowhere. But the basically everything converges on one point. So to an excellent precision, the unitarity is respected. The bottom line from this is that in this sector of the standard model, and also in the weak neutral current sector, which and the Z boson and its decays, and I didn't have time in this course to talk about that, mainly because that's sort of older. Most of that work was done 20 years ago, whereas a lot of this is quite recent. The standard SU2 cross U1 model was tested as at least in the interaction of gauge bosons with fermions at the basically at a 1 part in 1,000 level, and it works. And again, one really needs all the higher order corrections that are only sensible in the standard model for that. Okay, that concludes what I wanted to say about the CKM matrix and unitarity and so forth. There, what I want to now turn to is almost the last sector. Well, there were two other sectors to discuss. Yeah, one I don't want to say much about is the triple gauge boson sector. There are predictions, of course, about the there are predictions for this is W plus, W minus. This can be either Z or gamma. And there are predictions for various four-point interactions. I won't write them all out. And these are not as well tested. Typically, they're tested at the several percent level. This one is the strongest prediction, and it's this one is, I alluded to this last week, if you just do E minus E plus goes to W minus W plus, then you have several diagrams. You have the E minus nu E, E plus, W minus W plus. And then if you just sort of naively say, well, this is electrically charged, and there's some prescription for the photon has to couple to an electrically charged particle by some minimal substitution. I didn't talk about that. Then you have two diagrams, and you calculate from these. So this is not the standard model. This would be without the standard model. If you were to calculate the cross-section as a function of the center of mass energy, you would predict something that increases very, very rapidly. But in the standard model, you also have the Z, which to a considerable extent cancels these others. And so the prediction in the standard model is that it turns over. And this is related to the renormalizability. There's a high degree of cancellations. Yeah?
So if we didn't have the last diagram, could we find a group in which we could accommodate those W plus W minus gamma with gamma massless and the other two massive?
There were other gauge groups, like based on an SO3 that actually did something like that, but the cancellations were because there were additional fermions that came in and led to cancellations occurring in a totally different way. Anyway, so that's the prediction, and of course the data are, I'm just sort of making it up, but I mean the point, the data agrees. So I don't want to dwell on that anymore. It's reasonably tested, but what I do want to turn to now is the Higgs sector, which was the last big aspect. And the relevant terms involving the Higgs that we've already written these in some form or another is, I think I'm going to, instead of the Lagrangians, I've written these all before, I'm just going to write down the Feynman diagrams. So here's the Higgs, W minus W plus and nu mu, and there's a 2i g mu nu here, m w squared over nu in the vertex. And nu, as always, is 246 GeV, and the Higgs field in unitary gauge is nu plus h. So nu is the Webb, and h is the physical Higgs. And then there's an analogous diagram for the z. And this is 2i g mu nu m z squared over nu. And there is there are 3 and 4 point vertices, so-called Siegel diagrams, w, and this is 2i g mu nu m w squared over nu squared. And Z, 2i g mu nu m z squared over nu squared. And there are couplings to fermions that are diagonal in flavor. They take an up into an up or down into a down. And so if this is fermion F, this is minus I times the mass over nu. And there are interactions of the Higgs with itself, 3 and 4 point. And this was this is one here is minus 3i mh squared over nu, and this one is minus 3i mh squared over nu squared. I didn't write it that way exactly, but the point is that we had this quartic coupling lambda that sits there, which turns out when you work out all the formulae, it's, mh squared is 2 lambda nu squared. And you can rewrite this in the end as in various ways, but it becomes mh squared over nu squared. So where did I get the 3? It becomes what? G Fermi mh squared over root 2. It becomes g squared mh squared over 8 mw squared, and which is mh squared over 2 nu squared. Okay, so this is basically lambda. It's 3 instead of 2 because there's some different combinatorics of how you combine the different H fields with the external lines. But basically, in every one of these couplings are proportional to the mass of the particle over nu, or the mass squared of the particle over nu, or the mass squared of the particle over nu squared. So the Higgs couples to mass in some sense. Now, initially, we did not know anything. We did not know what lambda was. Initially, all one could say was that lambda had to be positive. So So that was the only rigorous prediction one could make. Now, one could actually do a little better than that. That's sort of the naive bound. There were actually theory bounds that were somewhat better than that, go under the name of triviality and vacuum stability. Which give upper and lower bounds on the Higgs. And I'm going to say just a word about those. And then there were, of course, experimental searches. And in order to search for the Higgs experimentally, you have to produce it and you have to detect it from its decays. And so the first, there were very early bounds looking for very light Higgs, but the most significant bounds were at LEP 2. This was the second phase of the E plus E minus collider in Geneva at CERN. And this is the same place where they measured that E plus E minus goes to W plus W minus cross section. And they looked for E plus E minus making a virtual Z, which would decay into a real Z plus a Higgs. So they were using this vertex, the ZZH vertex. And if this is if this is a real on-shell Z and this is massive, then this would have to be off-shell. It's virtual. Or in early stages, they actually had a real Z looking for a virtual Z and a Higgs that's only relevant for very light Z. But at any rate, this could be tagged by, for example, Z goes to mu plus mu minus, and for example, H goes to BB bar, for example. Assuming that the Higgs is not twice the top quark mass, the dominant decay mode into fermions is BB bar, because the bottom quark is the heaviest fermion other than the top. And so this is the dominant fermion decay mode. But there were other possibilities. They were mainly just tagging on the Z. Well, they didn't observe anything, and so this already set a limit, MH bigger than 114.4 GeV. Precision electroweak. Although I haven't talked about it, I've alluded to the fact that measurements of the properties of the Z and W at the 1 part in 1,000 were made. And there would be loop corrections to, for example, the W and Z propagators from diagrams like, this. This could be WWTB or Z goes to TT bar or Z goes to BB bar. Now, these have nothing to do with the Higgs. The reason I'm writing them, the top and the bottom are very different in mass. These affect the propagators of the W and Z, and they affect their masses. And in fact, they are corrections to the tree level formulae that I wrote down previously. And because of these very precise measurements, it was possible to actually predict the top quark mass to be about 160 plus or minus 20 long before it was actually observed. And it was observed in the right range. Now, that prediction was fairly easy because these effects actually go like the top quark mass squared over nu squared. times g squared, which is relatively relatively big because m top is big. However, there are also corrections involving the W or the Z, the Higgs W or Z, that affect the details. And these are much harder to observe the effects of because they only depend logarithmically on m Higgs over nu. However, I mean, the vertices are not logarithmic, but they're, when you actually do the whole diagram and put in the propagators, et cetera, it's a small effect, but nevertheless measurable. And this led to the conclusion that MH is less than about 150 JeV. And this was already like 15 years ago. So we were actually had fairly narrow range that was possible. And before the searches at first the Tevatron, the PVRP collider at Fermilab, and now the LHC at CERN. I have not talked about supersymmetry here, but as a possible extension of the standard model, I will say in the supersymmetric extension, there are two Higgs doublets, and there are several physical Higgs scalars. However, the lightest one, I'll call it H, usually acts very much like the standard model Higgs for most of the parameter space. And there's a theoretical upper bound in the supersymmetric models that's about 130 JeV. That's in the minimal supersymmetric version. In some extended versions with different features, it can get higher. But this is a theoretical bound in supersymmetry. So in supersymmetry, doesn't change the picture too much, but it's sort of constrained. So here, this is where we were a few years ago. The lower bound, theoretical upper bound, and if one goes to supersymmetry, another theoretical upper bound. Okay, what about these triviality and vacuum stability limits? Well, we've seen that gauge couplings are not constant. Gauge couplings, such as the QCD coupling, run. They're functions of the momentum that's relevant to the process. And it's due to higher order effects that can be universally absorbed into this running coupling. And so we've talked a little about the renormalization group equations, that the alpha strong gets weaker at high momentum, and the QED coupling alpha would get larger, etc. Well, similar stories apply to all coupling constants in field theories. And this lambda, the one that was in the original quartic potential, is, well, when I write a formula like that, what I really meant was that lambda at the electroweak scale nu is mh squared over 2 nu squared. However, lambda runs just like everything else. And lambda runs because of diagrams like this. So lambda is a four-point function. And here is something diagram that causes it to run. And there's another diagram from the top quarks going around a loop. There are many other diagrams, such as diagrams involving gauge bosons, etc. I've singled out the top quark here because the top quark has the largest coupling of Ibn fermion to the Higgs. And I'm going to focus just on these two. The gauge terms are smaller for, in the relevant regions I'm interested in. These diagrams have opposite signs. Anytime you have a closed fermion loop, it causes, there's an extra minus sign, so I'll write that explicitly. And the essence of it is that this makes lambda grow, and this makes lambda decreases at higher energies. And you can write down the renormalization group equations for these. And you find that, first of all, for large lambda of nu, and I'll try to quantify that, what that means, but if MH is fairly large, like a few hundred GeV, for example, then the lambda squared dominates. And if you do the plot, if you just calculate what happens to lambda, what you find is that lambda starts out at some value that is, here's nu, so here's some lambda of nu here, it increases. And at some, at some point, it just goes off to infinity. It becomes nonlinear, and it shoots off exponentially to infinity. And this is called a Landau pole. And it's very frequent in field theories that gauge that any coupling constants can go to infinity. Now, of course, and that was very similar to what happened in QCD. When you come down in energy, I said at some scale it just shoots off to infinity. That was basically a Landau pole also. Now, when you hit a Landau pole, obviously the theory doesn't make sense anymore. The approximation breaks down. To calculate where that happens, you're working to some finite order perturbation theory for the running. And so obviously that approximation breaks down, but it's unlikely, hard to prove, but unlikely that that will really come in and save you. So if this happens, you're in trouble. The theory doesn't make sense. But you can sort of evade that if you say, require sensible theory up to some scale lambda, capital lambda. In other words, if the standard model is only an approximation up to some scale lambda, lambda might be 1 TeV, it might be 10 to the 5 JeV, it might be the Planck scale where gravity comes in. At some point, the theory is going to break down, and you don't care if there's a Landau pole at a larger scale because the theory is not meant to be valid there. However, if you want the theory to be valid up to some scale higher than where this singularity, then there's just not consistency. It doesn't make any sense. So this gives a theoretical upper bound on the possible Higgs mass as a function of this lambda. If you take lambda to be 10 to the 18 GeV, it's basically the Planck scale. If you say the standard model has to work up to where gravity comes in, that puts an upper limit of let me try to draw this somewhat precisely, 200, 600, 400. Basically, there is a theoretical upper bound like this. If you say that the standard model is to be good only up to, say, a TEV, then it means MH is less than about 500. Or if you insist on the being good up to the gravity stick AL, it means the MH is less than about 180. So that's a fairly reliable theoretical upper bound. It's also supported by other related but not identical calculations. By the way, this is totally independent of the so-called Higgs hierarchy problem that I'm not going into right now. I'll talk about that on Friday. This is a different thing. So there is an upper bound. On the other hand, and it's really about 600 for any sensible lambda, there is a theoretical lower bound as well. That is, the second diagram dominates for low M Higgs. And that second diagram, if lambda starts out small, it'll eventually get smaller. And if it goes negative, then you don't have a stable vacuum. So the vacuum becomes unstable if M Higgs is too low. Again, if you say that the theory really only makes sense up to some lambda, then all you can say is you don't want that to happen below lambda. Well, this vacuum stability puts a lower limit that looks like this. And basically, the observed Higgs mass is here. Well, let me just say one more thing in words. This is the standard model. I said that in the supersymmetric extension, there was a theoretical upper bound because lambda is not a free parameter in supersymmetry. And basically, that theoretical upper bound in supersymmetry was pretty much overlaps the theoretical lower bound in the standard model. So for many years, people said, well, if we observe a Higgs and it's and the vacuum stability doesn't apply in supersymmetry because that means the new scale is already there at low energies. So for many years, people said, well, if you find a Higgs up here, it's consistent with standard model but not supersymmetry, whereas if you find it very low, it's consistent with supersymmetry but not the standard model. Well, of course, what's happened was it's now observed, and I'll spend a little bit of time tomorrow on how it was produced and observed and the decays and all of that. But it's basically right here. It overlaps this region at about lambda of 10 to the 11 JeV. It is uncomfortably low for the standard model because it says that the vacuum, actually, this says that our vacuum is unstable but metastable. If you're much below, it would be unstable. So if the V versus the scale phi, here's what you would have without those higher order corrections. And what you would get, that's without the corrections. And for I'm sorry, let me try to draw this a little better. You can erase that sign, yeah. So I'm trying to draw the potential, including these effects, and basically on this axis, I'm just drawing the relevant scale, which will tell me where the minimum really is. So this was lowest order, but including those corrections, an unstable vacuum would look like and a metastable vacuum looks like this. Or, I'm still not drawing it well. Metastable looks like this. That's metastable. What that means is if this is our 246 GeV, and the potential looks like this, then eventually the vacuum will decay and the whole universe will go up, poof, all of it. Now that's actually okay as long as the expected lifetime is more than 10 to the 14 years, or 14 billion years rather, longer than the observed age of the universe. Don't tell the military about it, they might get some ideas, but anyway. But people are not necessarily comfortable. Anyway, the observed Higgs, if you have standard model, is such that this is about 10 to the 11 here. And so the vacuum, if there's really no new physics up to that scale, then our vacuum with the Higgs as we have observed now is metastable. However, there could still be supersymmetry or something else, in which case that is cut off. There are cancellations to that top diagram and it becomes irrelevant. However, like in supersymmetry, it's somewhat difficult to get as big as 125. Okay, are there any quick questions? So I'll spend 10 or 15 minutes tomorrow on concluding the Higgs part, and I'll talk about production mechanisms at a hadron collider, and I'll talk about decay mechanisms and a bit about the actual discovery of the Higgs. And then I will turn to another topic that's part of the modern standard model, but namely neutrino physics and neutrino mass, which has been a major development in the last 20 years. So.